Hey everybody, how you doing? This is James. I am the founder of Unexplained Universe. We're going to be doing a show tonight that y'all are really going to like. It's called the Villiesca, Iowa Axe Murder House. We're going to go over the history and about the victims. That's right, the victims of the Axe Murder House. We're going to be discussing that. It's a three-part series. We'll go over the actual history, the victims tonight. Second part will be over a little bit more in depth into the history and the suspects who thought that these people had done the murders. Alrighty. And let me introduce who we'll have with us tonight. Tonight it will be Miss Amy Buchanan. She's a psychic medium she's with Cherokee Nation Radio, our parent company, and Unexplained Universe. Her name is Amy Buchanan. How you doing, Amy?
All right, how are you?
Doing great. Hey, also our next guest is a good friend of Cherokee Nation Radio and Unexplained Universe. The man is a paranormal investigator in his own right. His name is Marty Seibel, and he's the founder of Black Raven Paranormal. Hey, Marty, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, how you doing, James? Good to see you. Good to see you, Amy.
Hey, Marty.
Alrighty. All right. Before Marty and them gets into there, because Marty is a very I won't say expert, but he knows a lot about the Villiesca Axe Murder House. But before we do that, I'm going to go into a little bit of history about the house. Okay. I know we're all interested in serial killers and mass murders. It's prominent in here in our day and age right now. But long before that happened, before it became a way of life, two adults and six children were found brutally murdered in a small house, farming house, in a small Midwestern town in Iowa. It's called Villiesca. Now, during the weeks that followed these murders, the life in this town changed drastically. What do I mean? A lot of the residents of the town started buying reinforced lots. They openly carried weapons. They huddled together while sleeping. They were so terrified. Newspaper reporters, private detectives, they flooded the streets of this small Midwestern town. This was the crime of the century at that time period. In 1994, a couple bought the house. Their name was Darwin and Martha Lynn. They were of Corning, Iowa. They purchased the former house of the murder victims and opened it as a tour. It is now listed on the National Register of Historic Places. There's been numerous films and books recorded about this murder. But the thing about this murder, people, that nobody knows, it has never, to this day, been solved. No one knows who actually committed the murder. There had been lots of suspects, but no idea of who actually committed the murder. They can't figure it out. The murder actually happened sometime between 5 a.m. and midnight on June the 10th, 1912. Now, what happened there? The Josiah Beef family, let me show you Josiah here for you guys. This is Mr. Josiah B. Moore. This is the patriarch of the Moore family. Mr. Moore had taken his family to a program at his church. It was called the Children's Day Exercises. After it concluded, two young girls, Lena and Ina Stillinger, were friends of the Moore children. They wanted to go home with the Moore family. They wanted to go home and spend the night. Mr. Moore and Sarah Moore. Sarah Moore, let me show you her. There's Miss Sarah Moore, the wife of Josiah B. Moore. They agreed. So they went home. No one knows where the murderer was at that time. A lot of people said he was stationed in the attic. They said this man went into the attic and waited for these people to come home. The Children's Day program was held at the Presbyterian Church in Iowa. It was an annual event, and it began at approximately 8 p.m. on a Sunday evening on June the 9th. According to the witnesses, Sarah Moore coordinated the exercise. She was in charge of it. They left the program ended about 9:30 p.m. The family went home. The Stillinger girls went home with the Moore children to spend the night. They entered the home sometime between 9:45 and 10 p.m. Sometime during that time period, approximately 5 a.m., Mary Peckham, she was the first witness, said that she recalled the Moore's next-door neighbor stopped in the yard to hang laundry. At 7 a.m. that morning, outside, nor the chores began. None of the Moore family came out of the house to begin their chores. That seemed weird to Mary Peckham because they're usually out of the house doing what they had to do. So Now, what do you say? This murder, as I said, no one knows what happened. All we know for a fact is all six members of these people were bludgeoned to death with an axe. Yes, people, this is the original axe in a museum. This is the actual axe that killed the Moore family. They were bludgeoned with this axe. They had their heads pounded in. Now, let's go into the crime scene a little bit. The eight people had been bludgeoned to death with this axe you see on the screen left at the crime scene. It seems that all of them had been asleep at the time of murder. They never knew what happened. Doctors on the scene estimated the time of death was around midnight. Curtains were drawn all on the windows, except two of them, which did not have curtains. Those windows were covered with clothing belonging to the Moores. All the victims' faces were covered with bedclothes after they were killed. Now, anybody that has investigated crime scenes and things like that, why would the person cover the face of the victims with bedclothes? There's been a lot of speculation with that. A lot of them saying they didn't like the victims looking back at them from their dead body, or they actually knew the Moore family. That's why they covered their face. Now, a kerosene lamp was found at the foot of the bed of Josiah and Sarah. The chimney was off and the wick had been turned back. The chimney, which is the glass part, was found near under the dresser where it had been kicked or put under there. A similar lamp was found at the foot of the bed of the Stillinger girls. The chimney on this lamp was also off. The axe was found in the room occupied by the Stillinger girls. So that means if the axe was found in the room occupied by the Stillinger girls, then they had to be the last ones that were actually killed. There had been attempts. There was still blood on the axe, but their attempts were made to wipe it off. The axe actually belonged to the Moore family, Josiah Moore himself. The ceiling in the parents' bedroom and the children's room showed gouge marks, apparently made by the upswing of the axe, meaning when the man went up, the blade of the axe had actually hit the ceiling as he's coming down. So that means the man must have been, or woman, we don't know, must have been doing a very violent motion when he come down to cave their heads in. Now, a piece of a keychain, which I'll show you here, is still in the museum, as you'll see it right here. I believe that's the keychain. A piece of the keychain was found on the floor in the downstairs bedroom. All this was part of the crime scene. Alrighty, a pan of bloody water, it was discovered on the kitchen table, as well as a plate of uneaten food. Now, what does that mean? One plate. Remember, there were six people in this house. So it means the killer had tried to clean themselves up, and they'd also settled down to have a plate of food after murdering these six people. The doors were all locked. Now, how's that possible? How did the person get in if all the doors were locked? That means the murderer must have already been in the house waiting in this attic right here for the Moore family and the Stillinger girls to come back home. Now, the bodies of Lena and Ina Stillinger, which I'll show you now. This is Lena Stillinger. This is Ina. Now, they were found in the downstairs bedroom off of the parlor. Ina was sleeping closest to the wall with Lena on her right side. A gray coat covered her face. Lena, according to the inquest testimony of Dr. F.S. Williams, lay as though she had kicked one foot out of her bed sideways with one hand up under the pillow on her right side, half sideways, not clear, just a little. And apparently she had been struck in the head, squirmed down the bed, perhaps one third of the way. Lena's nightgown was slid up and she was wearing no undergarments. And remember now, this is 1912. Why would this young girl, this young underage girl, not have undergarments on? This is all speculation, remember. Was she sexually assaulted? Don't know. It was 1912. There was bloodstains on the inside of her right knee, and what the doctors assumed was a defensive wound on her arm. Dr. Lindquist, the coroner, reported a slab of bacon on the floor in the downstairs bedroom lying near the axe. Huh? A pound of bacon laying beside the axe? Why is that? Was this a robbery gone wrong? What? I mean, who knows? The bacon weighed about 2 pounds. It's wrapped in what he thought was a dish towel. It seems like the killer had went into the Moore, had been in the Moore's house, and as he's leaving, he wanted to steal some bacon to take with him. 2 pounds of it. A second slab of bacon, about the same size, was found in the icebox. So the Moore family had two of them there. Now, Lindquist, Dr. Lindquist also made note that one of Sarah's shoes, which he found on Josiah's side of the bed, the shoe was found on its side. However, it had blood inside as well as under it. It was Lindquist's assumption that the shoe had been upright when Josiah was first struck and that blood ran off the bed into the shoe. He believed the killer later returned to the bed to inflict additional blows and subsequently knocked the shoe over. So there you have it, what actually happened on June 10th, 1912 in Billieska, Iowa. Now, just who were the Moore family? Let's go back to Josiah. Josiah B. Moore, he was one of Billieska's most prominent businessmen. At the time of his death, he was survived by his parents, Mr. and Mrs. C.C. Moore of Billieska, brother John Moore of Summerfield, Kansas, George Moore of Portland, Oregon, Finn Moore of Red Oak, James Charlie Ross and Harry of Billieska, and sisters Mrs. George Fisher of Billieska and Miss Minnie Moore of Omaha. Josiah married Sarah Montgomery, which you'll see a picture of her again in a second, on December the 6th of 1899 at the home of her parents. Josiah and Sarah Moore had 4 children, Herman, Catherine, Boyd, and Paul. Josiah had been a resident of Billieska for 13 years, and he was employed by Frank Jones and the Jones Store for 9 years. So who was Sarah? Miss Sarah was the wife of Sarah Montgomery, was her maiden name, Moore. She was born in Knox County, Illinois in 1873. She moved to Iowa with her parents, Mr. and Mrs. John Montgomery and her sister Mary, in approximately 1894. She was 39 years old and the mother of 4 children when she was murdered in her bed. Yes, Miss Sarah was only 39 years old when she died. She was an active member of the Presbyterian Church and led the Children's Day exercises on June 9th, the day before her death. Her survivors included her parents, her sister, her niece, and nephew, and grandmother. Among the suspects immediately after the murders was suspected to be Sarah's brother-in-law, Lee Van Gilder. But we'll get into that on part two of this series. The ex-husband of Sarah's sister, Mary Van Gilder, had a few previous brushes with law enforcement and was known to be prone to violence. Although he and his wife had divorced, there was apparently enough bad blood between the two for him to be a suspect. He was later cleared. Now, let's go into the children. I know I'm talking, but I want to get you a background, and then we're going to go to Marty and let him tell us a little bit. He's been there. The first child of the Moores was Herman. This is Herman. He was the eldest of the Moore children. He was born in 1901 and was 11 years old at the time of his death. It was said that Herman was quite his father's son and was always near his father's side. This is Catherine Moore. She was born just 2 years after Herman in 1903. She was 10 years old when she was killed. The Stillinger sister, well, let me show you Boyd and Paul first. This is Boyd. Sorry about the picture, but it's the best we can find. Sorry about it. Boyd, and then here's Paul. We're the youngest Moore children. Boyd himself was age 7, and Paul was age 5, respectively, at the time of their murders. Only one photograph of the two boys has ever been presented, and you're looking at them. These are the original photos, the only pictures of these children that anybody has ever seen. The photos that I showed presented, they were much younger than they were at the time of their deaths in 1912. Now, the Stillinger girls. You ever heard the story of being in the wrong place at the wrong time? That was the Stillinger sisters. They had been to the Children's Day exercises at the Presbyterian Church, wanted to go home with the Moore children. They were very good friends. The first one you see, her name is Lena Gertrude Stillinger, her sister Anna May, which we see here now on the screen. And they were the daughters of Joseph and Sarah Stillinger. Both girls were born on the Stillinger farm just outside of Billieska. Lena, who was 12 years old when she was murdered, and from the position of her body, it was concluded that she was the only victim in the entire house that attempted to fight off her attacker. That's right. She tried to fight the killer. She had a defensive wound on her arm. Remember, I said that. Many experts also suggested that Lennon was a victim of some type of sexual molestation by her killer. Okay. Ina May, which we see now on our screen, and Lennon had seven surviving siblings: Edith, Ed, Lester, David, Blanche, Ralph, and Ada Lou. Both were members of the Presbyterian Church and the Junior Society. They participated with the Moore children in the Children's Day activities at the Presbyterian Church on the night of their murders. Ina was actually 8 at the time of her death, and the Stillinger sisters are buried side by side in the Villiesca Cemetery. Now, this was a very heinous crime. No one knows who committed this murder. A lot of paranormal activity occurs in this location. It really does. Let's go to Marty real quick and let Marty tell you a little bit of what about he has experienced paranormally at the Villiesca murder house. This house is very famous for being murdered. It still stands today, which I believe I have a picture of it here. This was the house. I believe this was the picture in around June 10th or somewhere after the murder in 1912. Marty, what just have you really, when you've been to the house, what have you actually experienced there as a paranormal investigator?
Well, we've actually been there on two occasions. The first time we went out was in 2012. We had actually watched an episode on television where I think it was Ghost Adventures had been out there. It appealed very much to us because of the history. So we went out and investigated and then went again in 2014. And a lot of the things we had success with was audio, in particular EVP, clips from the spirit box as well. But we had, I guess it was our first trip in 2012 where we had a really unique personal experience. Myself mm-hmm. and the investigator I was working with at the time, Michael Hoover, we were down in the parlor, and I was sitting on one side of the room. He was on a sofa on the other side. I was actually changing the batteries in my audio recorder. And I don't know why in the heck it seems like things happen when you least expect it, but here I am, I'm changing the batteries in my recorder. And he makes the comment across the room that his EMF meter is doing a quick spike. It's doing a couple quick spikes. And so he makes the comment, he says, "Children, are you here with us?" And I kid you not, a few seconds later, I heard a little girl go, "Yeah." And the funny thing about it was he heard it too. And we both looked up at each other in total surprise. "Did you hear that?" And he, "Yeah." And it was a girl. And "Yeah." And so the next thing I'm thinking is, oh gosh, I don't have batteries in my audio recorder. But we were lucky enough. We did have a lady that was in our group, and she had actually had an audio recorder running, recording on the coffee table downstairs, and it did capture it on the recorder. So that was pretty cool to be able to have a personal experience and then validate it with some real evidence and data, tangible evidence. That's probably the best experience, personal experience we've had while we were out there. And, you know, as a paranormal investigator, I've been doing this now for about 20 years. I don't have a lot of personal experiences, maybe 5 or 6. And that was one of them. It was pretty cool to be able to hear that in real time and then get it on the recorder as well. Pretty neat.
I can imagine that. Marty and I, to give you a little background, me and Marty have been friends for quite a few years. I used to be a paranormal investigator myself for quite a few years. Marty was my second in command with Old Dominion Paranormal Investigations. And if anybody knows this stuff, I have to give kudos to this man. He's very well trained in paranormal investigations. If he tells you something, you pretty much can take it to the bank. Trust me. He doesn't make up things. Everything that he does, Marty goes in, as I said, I've known Marty for quite a few years. He goes in looking for the natural explanation of stuff. If he can't find it, hey, then he comes in with okay, maybe this is paranormal. And then he looks at it from that aspect. But first, it's, let's find the natural explanation for this. Marty will take measurements to see if a floor is unlevel. Marty will see if there's drafts coming in through a window. He's very scientific with what he does. Mm-hmm. So, Marty, what is your opinion on the house being there, actually walking into a home where you know 6 individuals actually were bludgeoned to death with a wood axe? What was your feelings when you walked into the house?
It's not a good feeling. It's a heavy feeling, and I'm not anybody that's really sensitive to those type of things, but right. I did feel that. I think we all felt that. You can't help but think about it. What happened there when you go in there? You can't help but think about that. That's on your mind. What happened in that house back in 1912? And I think, you know, one of the things too that was even a little bit more unsettling was when they had explained to us about some of the marks in the ceiling from the backswing of the axe when the crimes were, you know, when the murders were committed. I think some of the things, you know, just thinking about how they were murdered, the brutality in it, you know, it's just, it just gives you a sick feeling to your stomach, and especially six of those victims being children, you know. And I think there was, from some of the research we had done, there was, we couldn't really discover maybe a conflict with how old the youngest boy was, Paul, whether he was four or five. And the reason I'm saying that is we did do a spirit box in there. Was trying to communicate with the children, and we get a very clear response, and that's actually up on the website as well, of a little boy saying four. We also believe we made contact with Ina and got an age from her of eight coming across the box, and all those are up on the website, and it come across pretty clear. And of course, we had the disembodied voice. The first time we went out, we went with just a group of four of us. And we spent the whole night there, and we ran our investigation, and then we did sleep in the house, which was a little hard. We didn't sleep in the beds. We slept on the floor in the parlor. We actually put sleeping bags down and slept, didn't sleep real comfortable, but got through the night. The second time we went out with a group of seven people, and we actually did this where we had two groups in. We had one group in on a Friday night, and we had another group in on a Saturday night. Right. The group we went in with the Friday night was all men. The group that went in Saturday night was all women. Mixed results as far as the overall investigation. One thing that we did have out there, which was kind of annoying, it had nothing to do with the house itself, was the women, when they ran their investigation, was the number of people, just spectators that would come up and come into the yard, come on the porch, try to come into the house, take pictures. As a matter of fact, it was so bad that they had to call the police. To come and get them out. And that wasn't a problem the first time we went, but I just think because of what happened there and the interest, it's one of those things. You know, people pass by it. Just the same thing with the Lizzie Borden bed and breakfast, and we've done that. I mean, all kind of people stop by. We've had people try to wander in the house there.
They just want part of the action. I'll tell you, that's what they do. They see other cars and they're like, hey, maybe it's a tour. We're going to go in. Yeah. But that's not how it works.
And that's the thing I have found here recently. There is more interest in the paranormal here lately than I've ever seen, really. And it's amazing that people are starting to actually put trust in the paranormal. They believe there's something else besides this life. Do we pass on? Do we stay here? To ask you, Marty, I know you mentioned the website. Why don't you tell everybody, we've got quite a few tuned in. Why don't you tell the people the website you're mentioning? Please mention your website so they can go by and visit, see some of your investigations, hear some of your audio. Please tell them.
Sure. It's blackravenparanormal.com. And also you can find, we have a link here to our YouTube channel as well. There's a lot of good stuff on our YouTube channel. We have videos on there of some of our investigations, evidence and data, sometimes just general history and you know, just previewing some of the locations. It's a combination of a little bit of everything.
Awesome. And Marty also does, it's the Haunts of the Queen City in Stanton, Virginia. Yours truly has been to this tour. It is a very informative tour about ghost stories around Stanton, where we're getting off the subject a little bit, but we'll get more into that later as we do more interviews. Now, Marty, you said about the furniture in the house. Is the furniture in the home the original furniture of the Moore family? Is that the beds and everything?
No, there's a few pieces, but most of it's replica now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they moved. They don't really have the beds that they were actually killed in or anything like that.
No.
Okay. Now, one more question I'd like to ask. I know this is a weird question, and people are like, oh, you're very sadistic, but we know they were killed with axes. Are there, from my experience of doing paranormal investigations or doing that, sometimes when there is heavy blood flow or something like that, it does stain wood floors or flooring. Does the Moore house have wood floors? Is there dark stains where you can see where the blood actually hit the floor, or was it all contained to the beds?
You know, I did, when we were out there both times, I never was able to see any dark spots that would suggest such. So I'm assuming most of it would have been on the beds. I don't think there was any that I can recall. There is one other personal experience I did forget to mention to you that Michael Hoover, an investigator with us at the time, had up in the attic. He actually did get scratched on the back of the neck.
Oh, wow.
And it's a situation where we were in there, and it's the first and only time we've ever done such, but we did provoke while we were in the attic. We provoked in trying to, I guess, attempt to communicate with the killer, and I think, you know, our emotions got the better of us, I would say. He ended up with a scratch. I think we have pictures of that up on the website, I believe.
You do. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I forgot to mention that. But yeah, the only time we've ever provoked.
Right. That's fine, Marty.
We just kind of let it out how we felt. Right. So to speak.
And sometimes, like I said, my experience of paranormal investigation, sometimes if you want things to happen, sometimes you got to provoke. You've got to get kind of make them mad so they can, like, actually react to the stimuli you're giving them to make them react and actually show themselves. And it's, as I'd like to say, guys, if you're listening, a full-bodied apparition, what we call, is a, you know, a complete human form. That's a rarity. You do see it sometimes, but it is very rare. We'll get into that later of what you normally see with paranormal investigations.
I think one of the things in regards to that, how it played out, was when we're in the attic, and you know, the prevalent theory is that the killer did hide in the attic. I think there were two cigarette butts that were discovered up there, you know, and it just wasn't a very good feeling in the attic. And the second time we were out there, our medium had actually picked up on such, you know, the presence of him up in the attic. I know how we felt about it personally. You know, you take anybody that could kill children and in such a manner, you know, we didn't feel like they deserved a lot of respect.
And I agree with you 100% as a father. Trust me, I agree with you 100%. They don't deserve any respect. So you've read the reports, and as have I, and I'm sure Amy, you've read a lot of the reports of the murder. Asking your opinion, it is a normal assumption that it was a man that did these murders because of the power and the force that was used to bludgeon these family members to death. It is pretty much a known fact that they believe it was a man, not a female, correct?
That's correct. And from my understanding, from the way it occurred, was he used a sharp end of the axe, and the first victim that he took out was the father, J.B. Moore, because he's naturally the adult, the male, the strongest probably in the group, and it's to eliminate him first. So he was taken out with the sharp end of the axe. The rest of them, the blunt end was used. And from what we understand, each victim received anywhere from 20 to 30 blows from the axe. So pretty, he much obliterated them, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. There was no, as we call it today, there was no open casket funeral, I'm sure, because pretty much their heads were obliterated. They couldn't have an open casket.
Right. And also, from what we understand too, they were not able to find JB's eyes.
Oh my gracious.
Either one of them.
And see, that's the thing. That's what brings so much note. Why does this, in your opinion, Marty, why do you think that this murder has garnered so much attention even to this day, in the century we live in now? This murder still garners a lot of attention. Why do you think that is?
Well, actually, I think there's two reasons. I think one, because of the severity and the identity of the victims, you know, an axe, it was brutal. Six of them were children. And then the second part of it is the fact that it's still unsolved to this day. No one was ever brought to justice with it. You know, they had a couple suspects. They brought one to trial on two occasions. The final one, he was acquitted. And, you know, it just remains unsolved to this day. Now, there are prevailing theories. I have my own as well. There is one book out there that does cover it pretty well, as long as with the paranormal experience, and that's Murdered in Their Beds by Troy Taylor.
Ooh, nice.
I don't know if you've read that, but I read it. It's a pretty good read. And he's got some theories out there. Mine at least aligned pretty much with his as far as how it plays out. based on the research and stuff. I do believe it was probably, from what I understand, someone just wandering around up to no good, meanness, found a house to break into, went up in the attic, and just decided to do some damage. Because after that, it, the fact that the railroad was running right through and nearby the house, that this guy was able to go, this killer was able to go from town to town. There were other acts of attacks, and I don't know if there were any murders, but there were in various towns, not too far from Valesta. I think there was some in Colorado, maybe in Kansas, you know. And shortly after this time.
Right. Now, and that we'll touch on that tomorrow night in episode 2, because we will go over a little bit more in depth in history. And also tune in, guys, because we're going to go over the suspects who they believe committed this murder. But from my own opinion, I don't know how my cohort here, one of my staff members here with Cherokee Nation Radio and Unexplained Universe feels, but from my own opinion, to read the story and see that 2 pounds of bacon was wrapped in a dish towel laying by the axe, what does that kind of tell you as the listener? It tells me that this was a hobo, somebody not up to any good, didn't have any food. Hey, he goes and he ate a half-eaten plate of food. Why would he do that? It kind of sounds like a hobo that was actually up to no good, as Marty said, trying to find some food, sat down after murdering the family, had some food, and then, hey, you know, let me take some of this bacon with me and take on the road. I can cook on a hobo fire by the tracks. And
there was also the theory out there too, as well, that perhaps he might have used it as a lubricant and sexually assaulted one of the girls. Yeah. Or he could have used it for something, for masturbation.
Right.
Well,
they
were mentioned in the book as well. Murdered in their beds.
Right. And it wouldn't be the first case that's ever happened.
Right.
And that's, and now listeners, everybody that's tuned in, now you know why we have this episode of Unexplained Universe at 10 p.m. till when we get done speaking about the episode 1. We do this because this is really not intended for younger viewing audience. Right. Because there are mature subjects that will be discussed, because you can't get to the bottom of the story or you can't get the history of the house unless you actually discuss it as adults. There's no way. Lena Stillinger, as I said, when I read you the history of the house, she had her nightshirt or her nightgown pushed up and she had no underwear on. Now, in 1912, as I said, people wore underwear at that time. Where did her underwear go? Where was it? Was this child sexually molested? But you have to remember, this is 1912. There was no such thing as DNA at that time period. There was no way to determine had she been. I'm sure they could have looked and said, yeah, she has been sexually assaulted. But if somebody's making that assumption, a pathologist or a coroner, when she viewed her body, they saw something on Lena Stillinger that led them to believe she was sexually molested.
Right.
Do you feel that way too, Marty?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think everything is on the table in regards to that. It's very odd that a pound of bacon would be sitting up against the wall. Just there for someone to discover, you know. And
that's me. I mean, if you're going to murder the family and you're going to take the time, if you're planning on stealing 2 pounds of bacon, going to wrap it in a dish towel, why, if you pulled it out of the ice bag, what was the purpose of wrapping it in a dish towel? Just carry it raw without a dish towel out of the house to the train, you know, go cook it for your hobo friends. Why? There's got to be some underlying instance there. The reason it was wrapped in a dish towel, that to me boggles my mind. Why was it wrapped in a dish towel?
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I've got a question.
Yes.
Back in the 1912s and stuff, did they have, I know they always had dogs and stuff with the police department. Did they have a search dog come out by any chance?
I think they did have a search dog come out. I believe
and
they
see did. And if he would have thought about it when he was with the bacon, he may have left it there thinking that, oh, if I take the bacon, the dog's going to smell it.
That's true.
There's a theory.
That's true. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure they did have search dogs come out. To go out. And one of the things it's not really mind-boggling, but the fact that once they were discovered and so many people descended upon the crime scene, it really contaminated or kind of ruined any kind of investigation, good investigation they were going to do. as far as the police department, you know, or whatnot. Right. They were late getting a start out and sending the dogs out and the teams out. And by this time, this this guy's probably got about a good four and a half hour start.
He did his thing and he left.
Yeah,
exactly. And my thing is, from what I read about the story, I've investigated it for years. Just it intrigued me. It's I'm not trying to sound morbid, but you know, these murder cases do intrigue me, you know, especially one that's unsolved. It's, you know, you want to, you don't want to give notoriety to the killer themselves, but you feel sorry for the family. This one, you got to remember, this was a mother. This was a father. This was their four children. I mean, the four children and two girls that were friends of their children. You're talking about an entire family was eradicated from the face of the earth and just eliminated, just in a blink of an eye. And and nobody knows who did it.
Right. Okay, we've got a question. Due to the violence of the crime, could it have been someone more familiar with the family? Rachel's asking.
And this comes from, I want to add to that, this comes from Marty's own daughter, Rachel Steibel. You need to bring her home a little bit, Marty.
Yeah.
Better, Marty.
Little stinker.
I'll give you that question, Marty. Once again, I'll read it. Rachel Steibel says, due to the violence of the crime, could it have been someone more familiar with the family? That's what your daughter wants to know.
It could have been, and there were some suspects, but it was not valid enough to even bring them to trial. They had alibis, but there were people that were familiar with the family, and there were people that had an axe to grind.
Right, exactly. And we will, Rachel, tune in tomorrow night because we're going to get into the suspects. I will give you a kind of a teaser a little bit. One of the suspects that was originally thought it was Mr. Frank Jones, the person that Mr. Josiah B. Moore worked for. Mr. Moore, which I'll get more into it, left the employ of Mr. Jones, went into business for himself, and people kind of say that Frank kind of got a little jealous of that because he got more successful than he did. Could he have been one of the killers? We don't know. We'll discuss that tomorrow night. Now, let me ask you, Marty, has the house been changed in any way since 1912? I know they upgraded the outside or kept it original as they could on the outside, you know, trying to take away the deterioration that's happened over the years. But in your recollection of going to the house, does it still look the same way it did in 1912 on maybe, for instance, on the inside? Does it look exactly the same as it did in 1912?
Yeah, they pretty much told us it did. They had pretty much recreated everything to look like it had in 1912.
Right.
And it's ironic, when we went out, like I said, the first time, 2012, exactly 100 years later.
Wow, 100 years to the date of the time. And you know what? If you keep watching Unexplained Universe, we're going to work with Marty and Black Raven Paranormal. Maybe in the near future, if we've got enough interest, we'll maybe rent a tour bus and have Marty, you know, charter a bus, and we'll take a trip out to Iowa and have Marty, as we're going down the road and we get to the house, before we get off the bus, we'll have them tell us a little bit more about the story. We'll do a day trip. If we get a lot of interest, hey, we'll do that. We'll work with Black Raven. Now, Marty, I know this. We have to remember. Let me put this out here for you guys to remember. Why did the murder of the Moore family actually lose prominence in 1912? Let me explain to you. Does anybody remember 1914? Does anybody remember what happened in 1914? From my opinion, I believe that people lost focus at the time from 1912 to 1914. Yeah, I believe people were around the country were still talking about the Villiesca Axe Murder House is what it's so famous for. But I kind of think it lost traction in 1914 because we all know what happened. The sinking of the Titanic, that became national news, world news, and people lost interest in the Moore family. It was a family. Oh, big deal. It was a family. Let's, you know, forget about it. Because here we are, we have a sinking of the Titanic where we're losing thousands of lives. More people became focused on that.
Yeah, it did overshadow those murders.
That's what I'm going to ask you, Marty. Do you believe that's what kind of put the Moore family murder on the back burner is because of the sinking of the Titanic?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I mean, that was top page news for a long time for the Titanic. I mean, it really put them on the back burner.
Yeah, you got to remember, I mean, here we have, yes, we had a murder committed, but then we had the sinking of the Titanic, which a lot of people consider that right. to be murder because they didn't have enough lifeboats. And when the White Star Line could have put more lifeboats on there and saved a lot of those lives, right. they wanted to save space. But,
right.
But we won't get into the Titanic. If we do that, we'll be here for hours.
And remember, guys, if you have any questions, please comment in our comment and we'll answer you. And I just want to give a shout out to April and Bucky and Tina and Marty's daughter, Rachel. Yes, hi, you guys. Ask questions, share, yes, enjoy ma'am. This. I mean, we're here for you guys to give you answers and maybe you can help us solve a problem. Who knows?
That's right. Maybe we have a Sherlock Holmes here that has read the case or maybe us discussing it will come to the conclusion and solve a centuries old murder that a lot of other people haven't. Maybe we'll narrow down the suspect.
Right.
Now, Marty, in closing, we're gonna close out for the night, but hey, don't forget to tune in next Saturday at 10 p.m. the same time when we'll mm-hmm. go more depth into the history of the Villiesca, Iowa axe murder house. Mm-hmm. We'll go into the suspect who they believed it happened. One of them was even a reverend.
Oh, I can't wait for that one.
What about that little teaser?
I'm getting my feelers out right now. I'm getting my feelers out who I think it is.
That's right. We won't mention the name, but one of the suspects in this murder was an actual reverend. That's right. Mm-hmm. A man of God, supposedly. But wait till you hear the story about this man. Whoa. Really creepy dude when I read about him. Marty, anything you'd like to add about or give to the listeners about this murder house that maybe we haven't discussed or approached on?
Well, I think overall, as a paranormal investigator, it does rank very high for me, this location. It was very high on our list to begin with, and it didn't disappoint to be able to go out and investigate it, see the house, and experience it and see what had happened there. It was about a 22-hour drive from here. We were very excited to go out there, as we are with all investigations, when the adrenaline's pumping and you're excited to get to a place, but coming back sucked. Getting home soon enough and getting in bed.
And it's always taking longer to get back than what it is getting there.
It seems like going there, the trip is short, but by the time you drive back, it's like, are we ever going to get home?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We had some great teams that when we investigated out there. We had good teams both investigations, 2012 and 2014. We did it a little bit differently 2014 because we didn't want to put seven people in the house at one time. Right. We were able to rent it on back-to-back nights, which was it worked out pretty good. You know, it's so much interest in it, I guess, just like I said, because it is unexplained, it is unsolved. Right. You know, and people, if you come up with a theory or explanation or anything to shed some light onto it, it's most welcome. And it's absolutely something to think about. We would love to go back again and investigate it and even film and document it, perhaps even put it on a bigger platform. We had actually discussed that with them a few years ago. I think it might have been back in 2017. We had discussed about doing such with them. So I don't know if that's maybe to come to, you know, being a possibility or not, but
checking out. If you get that as a possibility, Marty, let us know because Unexplained Universe would like to go with our cameras, maybe film y'all during your investigation. If you give us permission and the house gives us permission, we'd love to film the investigation.
Yep.
Show some of these people that love the paranormal, show paranormal investigators in action, and I know you're one of the best. Trust me, I know it. I've known you for years. Hey, you're welcome, bud. That's kudos that need to be given. You're great. But like I said, guys, we will close out for the night. You've heard the history and the story of the victims of the Villiesca axe murder house. I don't like to call it the Villiesca axe murder house. That is what it is known as. But right. In my respect, I like to call it the actual mass murder of the Josiah B. family. We need to give a lot of murders. We need to give more respect to the victims that actually lost their lives. Remember, yes, you had two adults that lived part of their life. They hadn't finished their lives. They had still many years to go. But you have to remember, six individuals in this house were children. Their lives were just beginning. Think about that. What if you, that was, the bad part is, everybody was lost in this house. I mean, it was the entire house was eradicated. That is something that is just, I mean, you don't hear that in the news anymore of a whole family being eradicated. This was a new concept in Villiesca, Iowa in 1912, a small Midwestern town that was sleepy. It just nothing. I mean, come on. It was like some of the towns that we've grown up in, guys. It nothing happens on a Saturday night. The biggest thing is, you know, everybody gets together and goes around a bonfire, maybe cook some marshmallows and hot dogs and has a good old time. But here's a small Midwestern town where an entire family and two friends of the family were eradicated from the face of the earth.
Right. And can you imagine what the parents went through of the two children that did die of their friends? Couldn't even imagine. I mean, all the torture and stuff to where they wouldn't know, you know, what happened to their children, who did it. I mean, you know, and probably to this day, the family's still trying to figure out what's going on. Are they pursuing this? I mean, there's a lot of questions that could be asked.
Yeah, one of the things that really made it was very hard to keep your emotions in check when you think about those things, and you are dealing with children that are murdered there because it's a location where it was a horrible thing committed there, horrible things committed there.
Right.
And to think that somebody would do that to children, it was pretty hard to separate those emotions and those feelings. And, you know, that's one of the things I'll preach a lot about to our group as far as where we go, is to block those things out and to concentrate more on the evidence and data. But it was pretty hard to do that there.
You have to block it.
I can imagine it was, Marty, because of the fact of being parents and thinking of putting yourself in the Stillinger mother and father's shoes of losing their two daughters. Right. I can imagine. I cannot imagine what this father and mother went through when they lost their two daughters. I can't imagine. I still have my children. A lot of us do. But just kind of for one second, walk in their shoes and think about what this mother and father went through. They went to their grave never knowing. Think about this now for just a second. The Stillinger parents went to the grave never knowing who eradicated their daughters. They never figured it out. Never know. There was no justice for Lena and Ina Stillinger. There was no justice for the Moore family. Someone died. And not to get into religion, but they died, and I'm sure they're going to have to stand before God and answer for their question. You know, answer, why? Why did you do this? But I want to thank you. I want to thank Marty from Black Raven Paranormal being with us tonight. Marty will be with us again next Saturday night if we can drag him, twist his arm a little bit, get him back.
And we'll drag him in.
As I said, Black Raven Paranormal is top notch, guys. Visit his website. I'll let Marty give it to you before we close out tonight. But I want to thank Amy, one of the staff members of Unexplained Universe, Cherokee Nation Radio, and our other ventures, as we call it. She's like an assistant here. She helps me run this station. She's really great. I want to thank everybody that's been here tonight, everybody that's tuned in. Thank you. And remember to tune in next Saturday at 10 p.m. when we'll go more depth into the history. But then we're going to be talking about who did it, who, one of the suspects. We'll talk about some of the witnesses that actually was there and what they saw or told to the investigators that came. But Marty, give everybody your website one more time.
It's blackravenparanormal.com. We have links on there to all our evidence and data. We have a link to our YouTube channel. There's a lot of good stuff on our YouTube channel. BitChute as well. We have a BitChute channel. You can check them out and see what we're up to. I want to thank you, James, Amy, for having me on.
Always nice to see you, Marty. And
good to see you all.
Hey, nice to see you. Hey, guys, and remember, like our Facebook page at Unexplained Universe, because you never know. We might work out something with Marty here in the future and might be giving away some tickets to his ghost tour in Stanton. He might want to just drop us a couple of tickets and we might give them away to some listeners. Hey, I'm telling you, if you Hey, that's right. If you win these tickets, I'm telling you guys, take it from me. I've been on the tour. You'll love it. It's amazing. He has some of the best tour guides. And if you're ever there during Halloween or in the month of October, guess what Marty does? He goes to the train station and does the ghost box. That's right. He does the ghost box to where he will actually hear the voices of the dead, of the people that actually died, come across that box. And believe me, I've heard it. It's real, guys.
The ghost box everybody. Is awesome.
Thank y'all for being here, guys. I appreciate it. Great show. Loved it. Can't wait till next Saturday to touch on the suspect and more in the history. But we'll look forward to you. Until next time, this is Unexplained Universe, and our catchphrase is, we separate fact from fiction. Yep. Y'all have a great night, everybody.
Y'all have a good night, y'all.
Good night.